The title of this one, if you look on the poster, is Publishing Poetry in the 1980s. It's going to be actually much more modest talk than that. It's going to be publishing my poetry. a much smaller field than we've been covering in the rest of the time. I suppose that the question that people ask first, the most often quoted thing that people say to me when they come across all this stuff, and I don't think it's a particularly intelligent question, but nevertheless it needs answering, is they say, well, why do you publish your poetry? To which the simple answer is, well, nobody else will. In fact, that's quite a time-honored traditional reason for poets to publish their own poetry. And the most obvious names that come to mind are Shelley and Blake, and there are all kinds of people who had to do the things themselves. I feel particularly an affinity with Blake because he actually got into the mucky business of getting his hands dirty and pulling off copies of books and so on. But a more realistic, a more accurate answer to the question is, the reason I publish my own poetry is because nobody else will do it in quite the way that I want them to do it. It's back to the terrible thing we were talking about earlier about what does a poet, how does he want it set up? Does the writer want it laid out? To understand that the press is about 10 years old, and to understand the genesis of the thing, I have to tell you that 10 years ago I was writing very, very tiny poems of just two or three lines long, usually on a kind of traditional theme of English poetry, on flowers and gardens and so on. And I was publishing these in the small magazines that were around at the time, and always was very frustrated when the magazine came back and you were looking forward to that marvellous book and you opened the thing up and you thought, my God, where is it? and you found it sort of packed on at the end of this long column of pages about the war in Vietnam. You know, you had something about a fritillary at the bottom. What cultural universe these two things sit side by side in. So after going through a lot of that, I started to feel that, you know, I've got to do it myself. Just about this time, another very important thing happened, which was that I got married. And this isn't as inapposite as it might seem, because my wife is an illustrator. And so it was a very obvious thing to try, at least, to work together. So, having no money then, as now, we were somewhat at a loss for a while to know how to begin, until I got the now totally naive idea that what I'd do is I'd save up enough money to pay for a tiny little card to be printed with a poem on it, take it to the printer, have it done, and then sell them. And when enough money came back, when the 10p's came in, and I had enough for another one, I'd do it. And so over the course of 10 years, we'd be a very purist press, we'd probably produce 10 little postcards. Anyway, in the event, the printer printed our first card and forgot to charge us for it. So we thought, well, is he going to go on doing that? So we took him another card, and he printed that as well, and charged us this time a very modest sum indeed, but at the same time made it fairly obvious that this was a bloody nuisance to him, producing these wee things. He'd really rather get on with his job of printing. I'll just show you the kind of thing that was done. Having said that, I've forgotten to take it out of my bloody bag. I'll show you the first card that we did. The idea, something David Smith was talking about was talking about Orwell and the way that he wanted in that book to have the text and the illustration or the photographs to have an equal weight, and that the one wouldn't be an illustration of the other. And this was something we attempted to do in the first place as well. I don't, as a rule, like illustrated poetry. Because if you talk about a tree or a hillside or a particular landscape, then each reader can go into the landscape in his own mind. Whereas if you have a delineated landscape there, it's that landscape that the poet is talking about. And there's no way of escaping that. So we wanted the two things to be separate. We've kind of got lost on that idea since, but we did it first. The first card, I'll show it you and read it to you, had a little drawing of some flower shapes on the front. And inside, the text said, "Fill in the drawing with colours from the palette below. Fragrant, drooping, glorious. Open, solitary, inconspicuous. Erect, delicate, persistent." But the idea of that was a metaphor between an adjective and a colour. And that, in fact, what you're doing with using adjectives is you're adding colour to an outline. That was the first one. The second one was this little card, which has on the front a tiny little drawing of a butterfly, which is in fact a fritillary butterfly. And inside, there's a description of a fritillary flower, which I won't bother to read. But again, the idea was simply, it's an image which I used several times in my poetry, the idea of metamorphosis, that on the front you have a butterfly which inside is metamorphosed into a flower, and it's like a conceit that a further stage in the butterfly's metamorphoses is into a flower. The idea about these things was that we would send them out. Again, we were a very idealistic voter. When we first published them, we would write out about 50 envelopes, and we'd pack them all in the envelope, we'd send them around to all our friends, as if there were 50 people in the world who were interested. And it was also in those glorious days when postage seemed a reasonable thing. But the idea behind it was that when you get a card through the post, any old card, you put it on your table. In fact, you give it far more attention than you do a fairly decent poem stuck in the pages of a book. If you've got a book, a Penguin book of 100 or 200 pages, and you read through the thing, you may go back to it again and again, but essentially you close the book and you stick it on a shelf and you forget about it. And since these things were about flowers, I wanted them to, in a way, work in the way that flowers work. That is, you don't go and look at a flower and give it your attention and then forget about it. You have it lying around, and it slowly kind of percolates into your consciousness and changes the environment in some slight little way. So that was how the first couple of cards were printed, up until the point where the first printer didn't want to know anymore. One of the great advantages of having a family is that they sometimes surprise you. And at this point, my wife's sister surprised us by giving us the belated present of a printing press. It's the only discriminating present she has ever given. It was a bloody great cast iron thing, about so big, with a treadle, and printed an area of 8x5. And it was really like the kind of Keith Robinson contraption, because when you press this pedal, nothing moved in it in the right sort of way. It all kind of went like that, and you're trying to hold it all together while you're flicking the paper and winding your fingers at the same time. And I printed one tiny little book on it, which I don't have, fortunately. I can't show it to you. It's my first effort at printing. Until we moved, and we moved into our own cottage, it was obvious that this bloody thing would go through the roof if we could ever get it upstairs. So we sold the thing to some fool who gave us £40 for it. And the reason for asking for £40 was that at that time, that was the price of a new little machine called an Adana 8.5, which is what we proceeded to buy, and it's what we've used ever since. An Adana 8.5 is about so big, and it sits on the table, and you press a plunger, and the thing comes up, and it kisses, and so forth. And it's the kind of press that one always sees advertised in Exchange and Mart. And it's really little old men with flat caps have down their garden shed, and they go down there and churn out these things. It's really designed for letter headings and business cards. And in fact, we do all sorts of odd other things with it. But the limitations are, it's called an 8x5 because it's supposed to print an area 8x5. Now, I've actually heard of printers who can print 8x5 on an Adana. I don't believe they exist, because the fact is that it's a very, very flimsy little machine. And to print something that area, you need weight, and it simply doesn't have it. So one can only print a little space adequately in the middle of it. So it should be called a 2x3 or something like that. So that's essentially what we've used for in the past 10 years, and we still use. During the course of using that thing, my poetry changed at some point. I started writing things that were longer than 3 lines. And the difficulty about this was that once you got beyond about 8 or 9 lines, the Adana wasn't satisfactory. So we moved back to using printers again for some of the stuff, which I'll show you. But for a long time, that Adana and my wife's illustrations were in some ways the most important influence on what I actually wrote. I used to write poems that would fit into that shape. I would occasionally come up with sort of like Ezra Pound writing a 30-line poem and cutting it down into that 2-line thing. That was the way I would go about things. It's a great joy about this. David was talking, I think it was you this time, was talking about the kind of mystery and the secrecy that surrounded early printing machines. In fact, I think some of this still survives, because there is definitely a magic about pressing a plunger and having a thing off that is printed. It's a very, very beautiful experience indeed. And this is why I said in the discussion earlier about the poet wanting his work to be objective. Somehow, if you scribble a poem down, wherever you scribble it down, and then you take it up and you type it up in the machine, you think, oh, that's pretty good, and you do another draft, and you think, well, that's okay. But then you actually translate it into type. Somehow it takes on a new life of its own, and it's a thing in the world with its own kind of responsibilities and its own possibilities. It's separated from you. It's like giving birth. It's like cutting the umbilical cord. That's the joy of the thing. There are, however, 2 enormous temptations. One is that having the night before, when you were suffering from insomnia, written down the 3 greatest lines in the past 10 years of the art, you wake up in the morning still full of it, and you rush upstairs, and you have this printing press, and you get it down, you get all this stuff out, and you do it, and there it is, and you think this is still wonderful because you've got it there in cold type, and you send it around to all your friends. And then about a fortnight later, you think, my God, that was a dreadful error. What a terrible poem that was, and I've now actually published it. That's one temptation of the press. One way of resisting that temptation is to have a wife. She actually can put herself in between my enthusiasm and the actual press. It's very good, you know, she's got a terrible fierce eye at looking at poetry, mine in particular. But the other temptation of having a press is that one becomes as interested in the production of books or little pamphlets or cards as one becomes in the actual writing of the poems themselves. And so you start to see catalogues of papers in front of your head and you think, oh, I could do something, you know, that size and that shape with that paper, and I could have another paper inside. And then you start to think, well, what, I would just have some words in it as well. What can I use? And so I'm afraid that's a temptation I've very often yielded to, is to produce lots of different kinds of books. And I think the best thing to do is simply to show you a variety of things. Since I mentioned the paper sellers, catalogues, I'll show you this particular book. A book called After Marvel. And as I'm sure you all here remember, the most famous line of Marvel's comes in his poem The Garden, where he says, he talks about annihilating all that's made to a green thought in a green shade. And this is a kind of, it's called After Marvel, it's a meditation on green thought and green shade. And you have the whole thing reversed.
Same upside down.
You see that. I hope that when the scholars come to study this work, they'll note the analogy to the formal gardens of Marvel's time. Because if, when you sow a thing in the middle, it's the same backwards as for in the second half as it is in the front.
Actually, it must be Marvel's. No one will be able to Xerox it, will they?
This is that disadvantage.
Perfect copyright.
It presents very little difficulties to textual scholars.
Have you seen Basil?
There's all kinds of stories about this book, as you can imagine. One is that I've got a friend of mine who's a private printer, and he runs a private press. Now, I must make the distinction. There's a distinction between a small press and a private press. I run a small press, which is essentially that I'm interested in the content of what I do, although sometimes it doesn't have any content. and the actual production, I'm bound to say, is a luxury on top of that. I like to do it as well as I can. But essentially, I'm interested in content. Private presses are run by people who are fine printers. And what they're essentially interested in is the printing of the book. And the text is more or less irrelevant. Anyway, a friend of mine came in while I was doing this thing. And I was trying to hide it, actually. But he came over and he picked it up. Oh, that's very nice. And then he saw me, I was sewing at the time. He said, "You're sewing it?" I said, "Yeah." I said, I like to sew it, you know, because it's a nice finish to have it. He said, "Yeah, but I mean, why are you sewing it now?" I said, "Well, you know, I've got an hour." And he said, "But surely you, I mean, you think I'm a pretty unorthodox fellow to start with, but this was just too much. He said, surely you're not going to sell the bloody book and then try and print it. The other thing, to again show you, can always tell a private press man, because you hand them a book, and most small press people look at the book and they read it. But a private press man does what this fellow does, is you show him a book and he looks at it like that. What he's looking for is impression. How are we doing for time? Right. Anyway, that was one way of doing a book. Let's just show you some other ways that we got involved. And this was a little book of haiku, Japanese, or like, haiku-like poems. There's a tradition in Japanese poetry of referring to a poem by Basho about a frog, which is the most famous haiku poem, and all the other Japanese haikus. Sooner or later, I feel we've got to write a poem about a frog, which is as good as Basho. So these are 13 little poems about frogs, and each one is 13 syllables long. So it's called The Frog Leaps 13 Times. It's bound in a traditional Japanese manner with a sort of complicated stitch, which I can tell you, since I sort of worked out how to do it myself, was never shown. It's a swine of a job to do. It takes forever. However, it has this advantage that if you print a tiny little book like this, it's quite complicated to do. But if you print a book as big as the Bible, you can still use the same thing. And you can have a very, very thick book and you still use the same sewing. So then it becomes very, very much less complicated than gatherings and all that kind of binding that we do. This is another piece of unorthodox stuff here, is that in fact I've used plain brown wrapping paper, which is something that most people would scorn to use in a book. But in fact, if you fold it over and have it printed on like that, it begins to look like some kind of smart, fancy Japanese stuff. I shouldn't have told you that. This is another odd little item. Because one of the points of all these odd visual things is that I'm really a frustrated painter. And I like the kind of objectivity and self-sufficiency that a painting has. It just sits on the wall, and whether you look at it or not, it's kind of a matter of indifference to the actual painting. This is a piece called A Still Life, which is just an unfolding little card and is intended to sit on your table. And I'll show you, it has four words on it. It's called four fruits. Apple, lemon, pebble, pear. Sits on the table. These are all, these two weren't. This and the other things I've shown you were done on Aradhana. That would take four printings, because it only prints one colour at a time. The largest, most ambitious thing we've done on the Adana is this little folder. There's two folders, one called the Proverbs of the Meadow, one called Proverbs of the Mountain. And these were imitation proverbs that I wrote, sort of in homage to Blake's Proverbs of Heaven and Hell. And my wife did supply an illustration for each thing, and again it was two printings, the sort of madder colour and black for the illustration, and we did a little folder of them so that they again that they could be separated and framed and hung if you wanted to do that. But that's about as ambitious as you can get with an Adana, really. You can't do anything vast. And so the problem arose when I started to write longer works, that that I couldn't do it on the press, and I had to find a printer, which the most obvious difficulty about that is financial. Obviously, if a man's doing the labour, you've got to pay him for it. And there's no answer to that, other than long, tedious search and getting things wrong and finding the wrong printer and having it all a disaster and it costing too much, until eventually you discover a man who is approachable and friendly and you can chat to, and who's very nearby, because you can't go charging around the country to look at all kinds of proofs and colours and stuff, but who's also very cheap. And I'm happy to say I've found somebody like that in the past couple of years. And he's printed lots of things. This is one of the first things he printed for us, a book called 16 Sonnets, which is rather large type inside. The reason for that was none other than that since I wasn't printing it, I thought it may as well be as damn well big as it. Then there was a thing called a dedication, which is a poem of, I think, 60 lines, which I've simply done in a folded sheet. The advantage of this is that it can unfold into a single sheet, and you just have one plate for the whole thing, and you just have one run through the press. So it's very easy for the printer to do, and most of the money isn't quite paying for the paper. And I think 300 copies of that cost £50, which is pretty reasonable stuff. Since we're talking about money, perhaps I ought to say something about that. Most small presses are run either on a loss, because the person who's involved with it is interested in the work that's being published and is willing to finance it themselves because they've got another job, they teach or they do something that has a decent salary attached to it. A few lucky ones who've survived and kept at it get to the point where they can just about support the press because they've been at it for a while and they've got known that they have a certain number of subscribers, and so they get enough back from the turnover of books to keep the thing going. My press is somewhat different in that not only does it have to cover itself, it has to actually make a profit, since that's the only way I have of living, that's my livelihood. And I think I'm about the only press I know of that does the whole operation and actually makes a small profit. The way I'm able to do this is, of course, by doing most of it myself. And even when I have a printer do a book like 16 Sonnets, I take it back and I do all the folding and sewing so that I can keep money down to the minimum. Quite how the money comes back is always a mystery. I can't give you a formula for it. One gives readings, and so, like, I gave a reading here last night and sold a few books afterwards. There are about half a dozen specialist shops around the country where things sell. And there are a certain number of individuals, which grows slowly every year, who have a standing order for things, so that when I've got half a dozen new publications, I send them off a little parcel, and they send me back a fiver, whatever it is. But there's a curious circumstance that attached to bookshops, in that I can't sell these things through bookshops at all. They don't sell. They never sell. The only, most bookshops that take them, I say there only are a few, take them on sufferance. because they're interested in the work and they have some sort of commitment to it. They buy half a dozen copies when they come through and maybe sell three after 10 years or something. Because it's got to do with the economics of bookshops. If you go into a bookshop and you have £2 to spend, you will probably end up buying a Penguin book with 100 poems in it for that price, rather than a book with 16 sonnets in it for the same price. That's one aspect. The other is that how on earth do you file something like this in a bookshop? Where do you put it? It gets lost. Or else if they have a little display, the things get grubby because people have thumbed through them, and so they don't sell. So people, when they come into a bookshop, think, God, that's very expensive, I'm not buying that. On the other hand, they sell very, very well in art galleries, in the few art galleries that I have them in, because people come in and they know that when they go into an art gallery, it's an expensive place, and that everything costs at least 50 or 60 quid. So they see a little book that costs £1, they think, God, that's cheap. It's exactly the same book that they've turned down. So the whole thing is entirely relative. I don't think there's a great deal else I can say. Apart from that, I mean, you can throw questions at me and then perhaps come and look at the books. There's perhaps one small thing that I ought to explain in finishing, and that is the name of the press, called Moscatel Press. The reason for that was that, quite simple one, that when we were starting the press, we'd just seen a moscatel for the first time. It's a tiny little green flower, which has, it's quite unusual, it's got a head with four faces pointing in different directions. Its other name is Town Hall Clock, and there's a fifth face pointing upwards. We just seen one, and it was our favourite flower of the time, so we called the press after that. The botanical description, Adoxa is its botanical name, which apparently means without glory. And in English botanical terms, it's usually described as inconspicuous, and that seems a sort of appropriate name for a press. Thanks.